Okay, we might get underway. Addy, he's kindly allowed me to call him Addy. He's going to talk to us today about the variability of weather index insurance, specifically in managing drought in Australia. Correct me if I'm wrong on any of this, Addy, but you were born in Ibadan. You went to University of Ilorin, where you got a Bachelor of Mathematics. You became interested in the actuarial way of life and went on and completed a postgraduate diploma in stats. And since that time, you've done an MBA in finance at the University of Southern Queensland. That's where you're at the moment, researching these bits and pieces. So welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming for this session. And I will be presenting on the viability of weather index insurance in managing drought risk in Australia. I know this is a very interesting topic to all of us. The fact that we are here shows we must be interested in it. And but by way of introduction, I will be talking about the insurance system, which we know that is getting overstretched given the frequency and extent of disasters, especially due to climate change. I was expecting you to be here. I'm happy you are here. Yeah, because I knew.
Thank you.
I attended your workshop yesterday, and thanks. Yeah, so it's like we are getting worried that if climate change tends to be going the way it's going, then how do we survive? How do we manage the situation? So the insurance system is getting overstretched. People don't want to bear the risk of drought and flood and everything like that, unlike other kind of risk, traditional risks that the actuarial community has been used to. And based on your presentation yesterday, you are basically sensitizing the actuarial community to the future risk that climate change poses to the global community. And to that effect, the Australian drought policy is re-examining its current state of perception of drought. So they are now focusing on self-reliance, that drought is no more a disaster because we expect drought. It's not something that we are unaware of. A farmer would expect drought, just as would want to manage every other risk. So the farmer should also be prepared to manage drought risk. So there is a paradigm shift from drought being a disaster to drought being a risk to be managed. And that is where we come in. And the debate on weather index insurance as dated back to 1984 when Bassley Abbey and Davenport presented their paper and said that, look, weather index insurance, particularly rainfall insurance, is not viable in Australia. But in 1986, Kiggins opposed that and said, no, it's possible. And with a lot of theoretical economics, the mathematics of economics, without much data, he argued that it's possible. So 1986, the same 1986, Bartley, the chief author in the Bartley, Abbey and Davenport, responded and said, well, get me right, I'm not saying it's not possible, but these are the conditions that will make weather index insurance, particularly rainfall insurance, to be viable in Australia. So that was where I picked up the argument. Okay, you're saying it's possible, you're saying it's not possible, it's possible to this extent, there's going to be need for subsidies. So let's see what happens. So in Bartley, Abbey and Davenport, they used 1945 to 1969 data, and as at then, climate change wasn't an issue. You know, so that's why I think, given the exacerbation of extreme weather events and by climate change, we need to re-examine that prospect, especially because the Australian drought policy is focusing on self-reliance. So the scope here is Queensland shares, and we are focusing on wheat and Western Australian shares. Bartley, Abbey and Davenport used New South Wales shares, and he acknowledged that with pooling of risk, there's going to be a reduction in the risk to the insurer. So that was one area that I did not capture that we tried to capture in this work. Basically, this is our general objective, And to do that, to achieve this general objective, we want to first study whether there is a relationship between weather and yield. Who would expect that? And what is the hedging efficiency of weather insurance? And can we diversify a portfolio of insurance contracts? So if we can, maybe it's possible. Now, enterprise diversification is a form of risk management in agriculture. I could decide to plant cotton, wheat, soya, you know, on the same farm. So that if this is being affected by climate to some extent, this may not be so affected. I could also decide to plant my wheat in Queensland, plant some wheat in Western Australia, you know, so that I can diversify. It's also possible to depend on government aid, and that is where this research actually comes in more, and insurance. And there are various types of insurance, multi-peril insurance, which you don't have in Australia at the moment, but it's currently being held in the U.S. But the same story applies. The loss ratios are too high for the insurance company. So we've talked about Australian drought policy. We have exceptional circumstances. So the government only pays out disaster fund when there is an exceptional circumstance. What is an exceptional circumstance? An exceptional circumstance is a circumstance where we are having less than, let's say we are having one in 20 year to 25 years drought event. So which is about the fifth percentile of historical rainfall. And that is where we are picking it from. If that is drought, then what happens if we design a contract with a fifth percentile strike, with a tenth percentile strike, and with a 30th percentile strike? So the problem with government aid is that it could be politicized. If you are going to become the Queensland Premier and you know that drought is setting in, what are you going to do? You promise farmers you're going to pay them disaster aid. And the truth is, not all the farmers tend to get the aid. So that's inequitable, it's politicized, and responses are usually very slow. So now, weather risk, like every other risk, involves probability and intensity of loss. And Adam Smith also said that the insurance market functions in such a way that we pool risks together so that we can bear the risk that could actually ruin just an individual. So there must be a way of pooling risks together. It divides among many the loss that could ruin an individual. So if that is what we do with insurance, then a lot of factors could limit that. Adverse selection. If we end up selecting those people who are likely going to be affected by drought, then that's going to take away all the pool of money that the insurer has. Moral hazard and other vices that I'm sure that we know more than I do. Yeah, so Keegan in 1994 was still arguing, said, if subsidies were to be paid to farmers suffering from adverse climatic conditions, rainfall insurance would be one of the most cost-effective alternatives. Meaning that, if you want to compensate farmers by whatever means, whether by disaster aid or by paying them, just in whatever way, it's better to subsidize their insurance. Let's take it for instance that those of you here, you are breaditarians. All you eat is wheat and flour products. You are fishitarians. All you eat is fish. We are living in a world where only those two foods are available. What's going to happen? Let's say the two of us, we eat meat pie, fish pie. We could eat fish, we could eat wheat products. What's going to happen is, if you are subsidized by whatever means, the fish, those people who depend on fish are being cheated because their taxes are subsidizing your own feeding, which is inequitable. But in any case, whether farmers are going to be subsidized or not, whatever kind of compensation they are going to be given, it has to be in the form of insurance, such that if we bear the cost of underwriting the risk, at least the inequity will be borne. I mean, it's not going to be too obvious, it's not going to be too wide, unlike when it's so politicized and it's obviously inequitable. When someone suffers from drought and you pay the person, someone else is suffering from drought, you are not paying the person, or other people are suffering from other kind of risks to their own businesses, they are not being paid. So it's still the most cost effect, cost-effective alternative. It's not necessarily perfect, but it's the most cost-effective alternative. So government policies, I found, could also deter the design of weather index insurance, because if I know that I have a chance of getting government aid, then I will keep taking risks. Isn't it? Because I know that the government is going to compensate me at the end of the day. So two major types of insurance that we know, traditional indemnity-based insurance and index-based insurance. Traditional indemnity-based insurance, we go and inspect the risk. How much losses have you made? That is very costly. Rather, with index-based risk contract products, I just stand there. I don't care how much losses you have made or you have not made. I just look at my calibration based on my strike. Up to this stage, rainfall, I pay you this amount, this proportion of your insurable interest. And that sounds like it's going to make things cheaper, but it's not always so, because it depends on the correlation between yield and the proxy. So the index is the proxy for the yield losses. So we have adverse selection and moral hazards, which are plaguing the traditional indemnity-based insurance. And to curtail that, we are using index-based risk transfer products to manage these weaknesses. But doesn't mean that the index-based risk transfer products do not have their own weaknesses. The chief of them is basis risk. If I'm insuring my farm in Toowoomba based on weather readings in Brisbane, we could tell that the actual effects will never be the same, because Brisbane is far away from Toowoomba. But if that is where we have complete historical data, there's no way we could design products for farmers in Toowoomba. So that's a geographical basis risk. Suppose I'm designing product based on the wheat growth cycle and you want to ensure cotton, there's going to be a structural basis risk, because your design is based on wheat and I want to ensure cotton. Or let's say that I want to buy weather derivatives from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, but the weather derivatives being offered there, they are based on cumulative cooling degree day, heating degree day, precipitation index, which are not capturing the phases of the growth cycle of wheat and cotton. So if I buy that to hedge my risk, beside the geographical basis risk, there's going to be a structural basis risk. Those contracts were designed for the energy industries. So we need something that will be able to manage the risk of farmers. So weather hedges could be derivatives or insurance. But people, what they do now is they are using derivative. Whether it's a derivative or an insurance, they have the same functional objectives. But because of the legal loophole, the insurance market is highly regulated. They are selling more in form of derivatives, whereas they are performing the same function. So there is a legal, it's just like we're talking about equity and we are talking about debt. Of course, there is preferred stock in between that is amphibious. It's neither debt nor equity. So there must be some legal structure to undo the possibility of people taking advantage of that. And the essentials of insurance contracts were premium and benefits, uncertainty and interest, but some scholars, legal scholars, have argued that there are other contracts that are not necessarily insurance that have these characteristics. So the difference is mainly in the intention of the parties and the duty of care. So I want to rush over this and go to some of my results. So in the future, we believe that the insurance market has a lot to gain, and even those who have been insured in the light of climate change. For instance, the insured will be benefiting 3 times more than it is today, and there's going to be benefit like 2.4%, 240% for the insurance company. So there's huge benefit in there for us, but we need to do a lot. This is the time to prepare for the storms of drought ahead. Cases of Mongolia, Kenya, and Europe. Chantarat, one of the names you saw in the beginning, happened to be a PhD student at Cornell University who designed the first pastoralist insurance in Africa for Kenyan farmers. And I borrowed some ideas from her. So we are using data from the Bureau of Meteorology and simulated wheat yield. That's part of the limitations of this study. And because we are aware that crops respond diversely, they are diversely susceptible to weather at different phases of the crop growth cycle, we decided to optimize the weight on a 10-10-day basis, the first 10 days, the next 10 days, and so on. So we optimized and found out that with optimization came an improvement of the relationship between rainfall, we are considering rainfall, and yield. Now, this is the payout structure. If the index, which is rainfall index, cumulative precipitation index, if this is the first 10 days, second 10 days, third, fourth, and so on, during the season, we're basically saying that we've standardized the values for each of the 10 days, and we sum it together, and we benchmark based on the 5th percentile, the 10th, and the 30th, meaning to say that we're using a 40-year period, and of the 40-year period, the 5th percentile contract, we pay only twice. That is 2 years with the minimum rainfall. So if those 2 years with minimum rainfall are paid out, how does it affect the revenue of the farmer? If those 2 years are coinciding with the worst 2 years of yield, we expect the insurance to be effective, since the premium is the same across the years. So if the strike is higher than the precipitation index, then we find that proportion here. Now, we used ordinary least square regression to establish the relationship, but we know that given extreme drought, wheat yield will be low, and given extreme precipitation, wheat yield will still be low. So we don't expect a uniform slope. Therefore, we used quantile regression to see the behavior of the relationship across the quantiles. Now, we also use panel data analysis to examine whether there is a panel effect, whether different types of contracts will have to be designed for different locations. And we use the mean root square loss to show whether there is a reduction in the semi-variance. We are not interested in the overall variance. Otherwise, we would have used standard deviation, coefficient of variation, and all that. But we are interested in the downside risk. That's why we used the mean root square loss. And we used the conditional tail expectation to say that in the worst 2 years, the 5th percentile contract, in the worst 2 years of rainfall, if the contract pay out, then there's going to be an increase in the worst 2 years of revenue. So if there are no matches, then the conditional tail expectation will be lower than when insurance is used than when insurance is not used. So that is what we also did, and we used the loss ratio to examine this. Now, in summary, if we look at this, figure one, this is the case study of Balone. This is the year when we've got the 5th percentile, the 10th percentile, and the 30th percentile contract paying out the maximum. We can see that only minimal yield loss existed. If it would match well, it should have been in 1995. So with optimization, we are able to match a little bit more, that the year with the fullest payouts for all the contracts at least is about a year when there was 87% of yield losses. And the actual year where there was maximum yield loss, there was at least about 90% of payout, so which is different from what we've got here. So it's been improved with optimization. So now, looking at this table, only 2 years, there were 18 years of yield losses. And with the 5th percentile contract, there will be only 2 of 40 years paying out. And out of those 2 years, out of these 18 years, there were 2 years of payout, and those 2 years are matching with years when there were losses. So losses without pay 16, pay without loss, 0. And it's matching here. But at the 30th percentile, there were two mismatches. That is, these 2 years, there were payments, but there were no losses. But with optimization, it became 0. It means everything matched. But the case was not the same for Westonia, because for Westonia without optimization, there were 4 years not matching out of the 15 years. And with optimization, there were still 3 years that were not matching. So optimization does not necessarily perfectly improve the contract. So I can't show all the results. That's why I just show this. Now, this is the case of a situation where the contracts we have designed was efficient. We can see that the variance in revenue decreased, whereas the variance was higher. For the income without insurance, the variance was higher. With the 5th percentile contract somewhere here, with the 10th percentile somewhere here, and with the 30th percentile, we see that the variance in revenue was compressed. And that is part of two goals we want to achieve: minimize the downside risk and increase revenue in times of drought. So here, this is a case of an inefficient contract for Westonia that I mentioned, but I didn't show the table. We see that with insurance, the situation was worse. It means it must have been paying out more in years when there were no droughts. So that's not what we want. So now, if we look at this, this is the case of the 10th percentile strike. We have the 5th percentile and the 30th percentile, but we are presenting only for the 10th percentile and not for all the shares. We did the analysis for 18 of the 100 shares so far, and we found out that in Ballone, without contract, the utility to the farmer is $90.26, but with contract, it became $99.65. There is an increase of 10.4%, but Buringa actually decreased, so it wasn't efficient. And this is the case of Westonia. It actually decreased. Excuse me. And for using the mean root square loss, that is here, the reduction is actually what we want because we want to reduce the variance. So what we found here was that without insurance contract, we've got 68.8, and with 10th percentile strike, we have 63.46, a negative change, meaning that we have reduced the variance, the semi-variance in revenue. And for Westonia, we see that this has increased. That is, the variance actually, the semi-variance actually increased. So basically, the results from the conditional tail expectation and mean risk square loss were congruent to some extent. But in some instances, they diverged. For instance, at the 5th percentile, we had 14 shares under the conditional tail expectation showing efficiency. 14 under the 10th percentile strike, we had 13. And with the 30th percentile strike, we had 12. Whereas with the mean root square loss, it was just the downside risk that was being minimized. So we had 12, 13, and 12. So it's more robust to the strike level, unlike the conditional tail expectation, because basically the conditional tail expectation say if you have 2 years of drought, those 2 years are coinciding with 2 years of payment. If that happens, so that the chances of that happening at higher strike level reduces as we increase the strike level. Whereas with the mean root square loss, it's about a pool of years of payout, whether the variance has decreased or not. So the mean root square loss is more robust to the strike level. Now, talking about the diversification. When the loss ratio is 1, it means the premium collected is equal to the indemnity paid. So, at the 5th percentile strike, when the risk was pooled for just 1 year, we found out that the chances of a loss ratio less than 0.5 was 0.73, but that is coming at a cost of high loss ratio. When the risk is pooled for 2 years, this is reducing. For 5 years, it's reducing. 10 years, it's reducing. And this is coming at a benefit of, we reduce this benefit, and we are also reducing this risk. Now, the 10th percentile strike was not shown so that it could be legible. At the 30th percentile, we see that for 1 year, is lower than 0.73, and so on and so forth. And if we look at the 10-year risk pooling, we find out that we have a trade-off here. No risk of high payoff and no risk of low payoff. So we are tempering the risk over time and with strike levels. So if we look at this annual loss ratio, Now we are designed, this is the annual loss ratio for Queensland, for Western Australia, and for the two shares when pulled together. Basically, we could see the most interesting part of it is the 2010. In 2010, there was flooding in Queensland. So the payout for drought would have been zero. Whereas the payout for drought in Western Australia was 22.76. Pulling the risk, we have 14.59. But this is not exactly half of this because there were 10 shares from Western Australia and 8 from Queensland. And besides, there were different levels of effect of drought. So basically, with risk pooling, we are reducing the risk as well. This is partial risk pooling. This one was temporary risk pooling. And we also found that the standard deviation of the loss ratio for Queensland was lower than for Western Australia. And when put together, it's even much lower. So it decreases along the quantile, the strike levels. Now, we have found out that crops are exposed variously at diverse stages. So the energy industry derivatives will not work for us. It won't work for farmers. There will be structural basis risk. And we found panel effect. It means that if other types of indices were designed as proxies for payout for a place like Westonia where the cumulative standardized precipitation index is not efficient, we may actually find out that it's efficient. Another thing I did was to cap rainfall at 60 mm because rainfall beyond 60 mm may not be useful for the crops. It may not be retained. So even if it's 100 mm of rainfall, I capped it at 60 because it's not useful. Anything above that may not be useful. So we found out that edging efficiency does not necessarily mean statistical efficiency because in all cases, optimization improved the statistical efficiency but did not necessarily improve the edging efficiency. Then in some instances, I found out that at the lower quantile, the relationship was stronger than at the upper quantile. But the edging efficiency are not showing that diversity so much. Now, we also found that drought risk and strike levels are based on the risk, based on the risk pooling, temporary risk pooling and spatial risk pooling. We found out that we could actually reduce the risk to the insurer with temporary and spatial risk pooling. And over the long run, in the long time, the insurer is more likely going to make profits. It's not going to be a short-term business, and who bears the cost of risk? Just like the case of those people eating bread alone and those people eating fish alone. It means that if the farmers are left alone to bear their own risk, that cost of insurance will reflect in this particular instance wheat products. So it means those who are consuming bread, the market will be operating, those who are consuming bread will be the one paying the cost of insurance, at least to some extent, rather than the government using taxpayers' money to compensate those who are eating bread. So basically, we are saying that the insurance market should be left alone to operate to manage the risk of farmers. In the end, it will pay off because the market will be allowed to operate and it will solve the politicization of drought risk, the inequitability of drought risk, and slow response. So basically, we are saying that contracts should be localized. The index I'm going to design for Westonia may be different from the index I'm going to be designing for Baloney. So that's one thing. And reinsurance would have to come in because the results were only most congruent at the lowest tail. And that's the section where insurance don't want to bear the risk. At higher strike levels, it's more beneficial to the insurer, but not maximally beneficial to the insured. So what's going to happen here is that there's going to be need for insurance and methodology. We need a lot of methodological help, and that is why we need to present a work like this to actuaries, because the risk is not, the relative risks were not, well captured in the analysis. We find out that the cost may even be more in a share where the index was not very effective than in a share where it's more effective. Contract improvements, and that is one area where we need to work hard on. It's not just going to be rainfall. There's going to be multi-trigger indices that will capture soil moisture capability, temperature, and rainfall. And that is beyond my scope at the moment. So I just want to at least get a PhD for now. Willingness to pay. Willingness of farmers to pay is also very, very important. Our risk pooling, temporal and spatial, assumes that all farmers, representative farmers from each share will be interested in the contract. If those for whom the contract were not efficient decides to pull out, then there will still be adverse selection. So it's not true that whether index insurance prevents adverse selection. It may prevent some form of adverse selection, but it's creating another type of adverse selection. If I know that the contract is not going to be efficient for me, I won't take it. So only those for whom the contract will be efficient will be taking it. And that is going to increase. It means that theoretically, that's a theoretical loss ratio. A practical loss ratio will be different from that. So Adam Smith's perception of the insurance system as bearing, dividing among many the losses that could ruin individual will not work, because there's another form of adverse selection. And then the legal framework. You know, finance people are very smart. They're among the smartest people in the world. So there has to be a legal framework to manage weather derivatives. And that is my short presentation for now. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks, Adam. If some questions, do you want to jump up at the microphone over there? Would be great.
Thanks very much. It's a great presentation, and
thank you.
I'm happy with the data set that you used, because the Pacific Decadal Oscillation was in the positive phase from most of that data set, from about 1980 through to about 2010. The Pacific Decadal Oscillation has always determined the size of the crops in Australia.
Yes.
You know, that's why the farmers talk about 30 years of famine and 30 years of drought type weather and 30 years of plenty of rain. So you're basing your stats on the dry period. If you looked at, you know, if you had data which went back another 20 years, then you would have the full Pacific Decadal Oscillation cycle, which would give you some slightly different results. It's not the only cycle that affects Australia's cropping ability. There's the Indian Ocean Dipole. And I'm not sure exactly what triggers the Indian Ocean Dipole, because that doesn't work on the same cycle as the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. But I just want to talk about the Pacific Decadal Oscillation for a second. Back last year, I think it was the 1st of July, we had a leap second. You might remember seeing it in the paper. You know, all our watches had to be put forward a second, if you bothered. But the atomic clocks on Earth were put forward a second. The reason for that is that the gravity from the moon, and particularly when the sun is in behind it, and even more if Venus is in line as well, those gravity forces slow the rotation of Earth down. And the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, strangely enough, flips from positive to negative phase when the from negative to positive phase, it flips when the rotation, when the slowdown in Earth's rotation rate, it's only in milliseconds, but when that is the greatest, and it flips back from positive to negative, no, sorry, it flips back from negative to positive when the when the rotation rate of Earth changes is the least. And that's quite fascinating. I'm basing this on a study by an Australian scientist by the name of Ian Wilson. He's an astronomer. He lives up in Queensland. He's sort of retired now, but he's a mathematician, and he taught up at the university up there as well. So that's what triggers the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. And the Pacific Decadal Oscillation is just the long-term structure of the El Nino, La Nina Southern Oscillation Index, because you get far more El Ninos in the positive phase of Pacific Decadal Oscillation, and then you get far more La Ninas in the negative phase. Okay, so that's you know, just one of the cycles. Now, I talked about a few cycles yesterday, if anybody came to my paper. I don't know enough about the Indian Ocean Dipole, so I can't talk about that. But obviously, that's a cycle that needs to be studied.
Yeah, I actually looked into Professor Ogastone's work, and he studied the Southern Oscillation Index relationship with wheat yield. So basically, that's part of what that's on a more national basis.
Yeah.
So maybe we talk more.
Yeah.
Once I'm through with after the other questions in this session, then we know how we can make that work. Thank you very much, sir.
Because there's another big cycle going on at the moment, so I don't know what the effect of it is.
Yeah, thank you.
Wasn't sure what the question was there, but anyway. thanks for the presentation. Just from a... it was quite theoretical, but from, I'm interested in the practical side of it.
Yes.
Have you actually, and I haven't read the paper, so I acknowledge that, but have you done any work around sort of design and in particular dealing with the anti-selection risk in terms of an actual product? I'd be interested to see that, because one of the things that actually has prevented underwriters from actually pursuing this is how to deal with the anti-selection, because farmers are very, very clever. And so anything that you've got on that perspective. And then one of the things that we've, from an insurance perspective, where you can, we've been thinking about the anti-selection is to have two triggers rather than just having the rainfall deficit being the trigger, that there has to be a demonstrated loss. So, for example, related back to the financials of the farmer or something like that. So just a couple of things around the practical aspects, if you've done any work.
Thank you very much. Let me confess that I'm a teacher. Becoming an actuary, as you've heard from my background. So I don't know so much about actuary sciences. I'm just taking the risk of my life by coming into this realm, one. Two, and coming in particular into this mysterious, you know, field of study. Because when I, and also, this is PhD. So this possibly, it was amazing when the paper was accepted in this presentation. Whereas in other conferences, I was at best given a position to come and present a poster. So I know we want something very practicable. And that was why I was emphasizing that in theory, this looks cool. But in practice, you know, the willingness to pay of farmers, because they know they have been farming there for the past, maybe before I was born, and I'm now coming with a product. So I don't, in terms of anti-selection, practical issues, I don't know too much yet in terms of the practical side of things. And that's part of why I'm excited to make the presentation and possibly have hands on deck to do that. But in terms of multi-trigger, that definitely has to be, because there are interactions between rainfall, temperature, and soil moisture. And as I said, it's beyond it's beyond my competencies for now. So the best I can do, I could say the best I'm doing with this work is to sensitize, you know, maybe push things to people who are smarter and more experienced and more into the practical aspect of it, and bring hands on deck and possibly help in facilitating response to drought in Australia. So I must confess that in the more practical sense, I'm not too much into that yet.
I think it's a good question. And, you know, I encourage you to get into the practical side. I have a bit of history in this area and actually worked with your boss up there 5 years ago now. And, you know, the theory's... the theory's great and the theory's solid, and we just found so many practical issues when we got into it, not just the selection but the moral hazard, removing the basis risk to an acceptable level. Getting these types of contracts recognised by the regulators was another
Diversity of wits themselves, because there are all sort of wits, you know, that you can plant. So then, in terms of seasons,
well, that's quite important. And one of the things you know, agriculture relies on is farmers using their smarts to, you know, best prepare their fields. And you know, there's evidence that the existence of insurance contracts, you know, creates a bit of a moral hazard that they don't, you know, they don't rotate their crops as much. They don't put in the same sort of level of care that they might do if they didn't have the insurance. So there's a lot of real practical issues, and you know, drawing correlations between, you know, different you know, meteorological events and yields is very tricky, is difficult. I would say what's more difficult is getting something practical to an insurance company that they could take to market. So I find that probably the most interesting and difficult area in all of this.
Yeah. Maybe when I get my PhD first, we can I can become more practical. Thank you.
Any more questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Don't forget your feedback forms. And I'd like to thank Addy for his lovely presentation. And you get a little gift here from the Institute.